Cass went ahead and popped that one too.
I just wanted to block her thing. Oh, they went close to the keyboard too.
That's probably true.
So for those of you who don't know me, I am Mena Fisher. I'm a psychologist that works at Mercy Health Hospital. I am part of the primary care team, so I work a little bit differently than you expect out of a therapist. I'm embedded into the medical team, and so I address any medical or mental health concerns that come up with my patients. And today we are going to talk about kids who worry, which is a very common occurrence. We'll talk a little bit about how to be helpful and when to ask for help. So hopefully, after I finish all this, you'll understand a little bit more about anxiety and fears and worries and where they come from, how they develop in the body, what kinds of fears are normal, why some children seem to worry more than other children, and then how to support children. And the main kind of goal with this is to differentiate between short-term parenting and long-term parenting. Short-term parenting is here and now. What do I need to do to get my kids through the situation? I just need to do what we have to do. I need them to not get in my way, and I'm going to parent, which might be effective right now, but might not be effective in the long term. Long-term parenting is I want to give my kids skills that they can use moving forward when they come across similar situations or when they become, hopefully, a healthy adult when they come across those situations that make them nervous, that cause anxiety. How are they going to be able to handle that? And then some signs that you might need professional support. So let's talk a little bit about where anxiety comes from. So anxiety is part of your brain structure. It is found in that little spot right in the middle, the medial temporal lobe, called the amygdala. And that is a part of your brain, part of your limbic system or your general emotional processing system. And it is there to detect danger and to let you know when something might be possibly dangerous, when you should start being afraid, and when you have to do something about it. And what it does is it activates a response called the sympathetic nervous system, which is a very predictable biological cascade of events. So your brain says, hey, there's danger, alarm goes off, and your heart starts racing, and your blood starts going to your extremities, shuts down any systems that it doesn't think is important right now, like your GI system, right? If you're in the middle of running from a bear that's trying to chase you, right now you don't have to worry about digesting lunch. You just have to worry about running, right? And so it activates all the systems, sends out all the hormones that your body needs to prepare to fight or run or deal with the situation. Sometimes called the fight or flight response, like fight or freeze response, which is usually how people know it, or the stress response. And so you might be thinking, if we understand where anxiety and worry come from, it's this little thing called the amygdala, so why don't we just line up all the kids with worry and anxiety, and we'll just do neurosurgery and take that little piece out of all their brains, and they won't have worry, right? And there's actually studies where they did this on animal studies, and they took the amygdala out of animals' brains, and animals had no more fear. There was no worry at all, right? So why don't we do that to all the kids that are anxious? And the reason is because there's a reason why that's in your brain. It's helpful. It helps protect you. It keeps you safe. Keeps you from jumping over the edge. It also helps you perform at your best, right? When you have a deadline and you start getting worried about it and you start preparing, that's your amygdala kicking into high gear saying there's potential danger here. You might not meet your deadline. You might get fired from your job. You need to start doing something about this.
Okay.
So it's that responsibility piece, right? So there's some kids we wish they were a little bit more anxious. Right? But anxiety helps keep us safe and helps us perform effectively. Now, the relationship between stress, anxiety, and performance is what we call a curvilinear relationship. In its optimal form, straight in the middle, there's just enough anxiety to keep me moving, to keep me going, to keep me safe, but not getting in my way. So it's when I'm functioning at my best. When we have too much anxiety, or the anxiety becomes overwhelming, I become stuck, I become frozen, I can't deal with the situation effectively. And also, on the other end, when we have too little anxiety, I'm not keeping myself safe, I'm not running out of the house when the fire alarm is blaring, and I'm not being responsible, meeting my deadlines, taking care of the things I have to take care of. So it's important to have anxiety, and that's really important to keep in mind as we go through the rest of the class, because We're not trying to get rid of anxiety. It's very important to have anxiety. We want anxiety. It's functional. It's helpful. The question is, when does it start getting to that side of the curve? When does it stop being helpful? When does it cause us to flight or freeze or fight in situations when we don't have to? Worries are normal. Right? Our brain is hardwired to do this. We're supposed to worry. Fears, worries, nervousness in unfamiliar or stressful situations are common for children. Right? Think about the first time that you ever did something, a new situation. Normal to have a little bit of concern that something might go wrong or something can be unexpected. And these fears are an expected part of child development, right? Just about 9 months old, we expect that children will start recognizing people that don't look like their parents, and they're going to be afraid of them, right? It's a normal developmental response. We don't think that there's something wrong with a kid who starts crying when they're going to a stranger's arms, okay? And then generally, these kind of normal expected part of development worries, they resolve when the new situation or the developmental stage is mastered. So once I get used to having strangers around, once I get used to going to first grade and being in a big school building, the anxiety can calm down. Some common childhood anxieties that come up. There's generalized anxiety, which is those kids that are constantly worried about anything and everything that comes up. They're worried about the weather and about safety and about school and about whatever you can think of, they'll find a worry about it. Separation anxiety, a fear of being separated from a parent or a primary caregiver. Social anxiety, or fear in social situations. Selective mutism, these are kids who refuse to speak in specific situations, usually at school. Specific phobias, those are the kids that are afraid of one specific thing, of thunderstorms, of flying, of bugs, of fire, of dogs, of clowns, whatever it is. Scared of that one specific thing.
Cicadas.
Mm-hmm. Health anxiety, fear of sickness and health concerns, which is what we were talking about. And performance anxiety, which is really part of social anxiety, but it's when the social anxiety is only present when spotlight's on me, I'm in the front and having to perform, whether I'm in a play, a choir, giving a speech, standing up in front of the class and doing something. And then I put OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in smaller letters because in the new diagnostic manual that we use, the DSM-5, they were taken out of the anxiety category. So they're no longer considered anxiety disorders. They're considered their own disorders, but I kind of consider them anxiety adjacent because they have a lot of similar features of anxiety. And they kind of the source of them is also the amygdala fight or flight system. So OCD refers to obsessive preoccupation and a lot of repetitive behaviors that try and reduce that anxiety, and PTSD or post-traumatic symptoms. So hypervigilance, flashbacks, nightmares of any event that was seeing somebody or experiencing potential harm or threat, so emotional or physical safety. So if we're saying that worries are normal, we're all supposed to worry, and this amygdala thing is part of our brain whether we like it or not, when is it a problem? So for some people, the fire alarm goes off too often when there's not a real fire. So our brain can't tell the difference. The amygdala can't tell the difference between a real fire and a fake fire. It's like your fire alarm that can't tell the difference between when there's actually a fire in your house and when you're burning your schnitzel, right? It's going to go off either way. The question is, how often is it doing that? Is it kind of hyper-tripping? And then we'll talk a little bit about how to differentiate between those two. But the key point is that it's not what the child is worrying about. It could be about anything. It could be about health. It could be about cicadas. It could be about standing in front of their class. That is not what makes worry a problem. What makes worry a problem is how much it's interfering with their functioning. How much is it impacting their daily living? And usually when we're doing an evaluation for this, we'll look at the duration, we'll look at the frequency, the intensity, we'll look at, you know, how long it's been going on, how long it lasts for when it does, how often is it happening, how intense, how high does that anxiety go when you're faced with this thing that you worry about. That's kind of how we gauge interference. Lynn Lyons puts this in a really great way. Lynn Lyons is the author of a great book called Anxious Parents, Anxious Children. One of the two of those. And she says that if you boil down all anxiety to one line, it's blah, 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 and you can't handle it. So Like, I don't care what you put in front of that sentence. It could be there's going to be a bug. It could be there's going to be a flood. It could be there's going to be a fire. It could be you're going to fall flat on your face. They're not going to like you. You're going to get really sick. You won't be able to handle it. That's kind of the core of all anxiety disorders. You won't be able to handle it. All right, so your anxiety says, well, what if this happens? And your logical brain says, no, it won't. And your anxiety says, well, what if it does? And then you kind of get stuck in that, oh, wait a minute, it might. Okay. So a lot of parents want to know, why does my child seem to worry more than typical children of their age? So if it's not about what they're worrying about, it's just about how much it's interfering. Why does my kid get so stuck on worry? So there's a couple of components to this. The first is a biological component. So there seems to be a strong genetic component when it comes to anxiety. Kids that have anxiety are much more likely to have a family member that has anxiety. There's some personality differences. So you can see from a very young age some temperamental differences that kids who end up being more anxious as they get older have. And then there's just neurological functioning. So the way that your brain is hardwired, the way that your neurochemistry works, just different for different people. Then we have model behaviors. So if you're around people that worry a lot and you're nurtured into worry or are constantly being warned that the world is a scary, dangerous place, that can also foster a lot of anxiety. And then there's environmental factors. So any event that disrupts a child's sense of structure and order in the world, so a significant event or situation that teaches the child the world is not a safe place and you have to be on constant alert for things not being safe. And then there are some contributing health factors. Sleep has been shown to significantly increase anxiety, so you ever notice that kids who don't sleep as well are much more cranky in the morning, very agitated, very irritable, anything you say makes them snap. So that's the sleep component. Movement, physical activity has been shown to be significantly correlated with anxiety. So kids that are more sedentary, get a lot of screen time, a lot, end up also having more anxiety. And the opposite is true. In research, it shows that kids who are more active seem to have a significant effect on reducing anxiety. And then nutrition, so blood sugar levels. Have you ever heard of the term hangry? So when you're hungry and your blood sugar drops and you get more agitated and you get snappy on things that you're not usually snappy about. And so nutrition and blood sugar levels can also affect anxiety. And then precocious puberty is when children go through physical development earlier than their peers, which can just cause some anxiety about, is this normal? Am I okay? Are people going to notice some anxiety around that? Let's talk about the things that are not helpful. And you'll notice that the things that we talk about that are not helpful, these are the two main things that people do that are not helpful. And usually they're focused on short-term parenting because it does work in the moment. You will get through the day and you'll get your kid to do what they need to do and they won't get in your way. So the first one is minimizing the child's feelings and perspective. So it's not a big deal, just grow up, stop worrying, it's fine, it's not something to be worried about, it's okay. But what that does is teaches the kid that their instinct is unreliable. So when that fight or flight system goes off, when that alarm system is running, you can't trust it, right? What you're feeling is not really what you're feeling. It's not okay to be feeling that. It's not really appropriate to be feeling that at this time. And then they start not trusting whether or not, what is this? My alarm is going off. What we want kids to be able to do is to trust their alarm system. We want them to say, hey, my alarm is going off. Is this a fire or is this my sniffle burning? Okay. But if we don't trust the alarm system at all, then we're almost kind of creating more anxiety about the alarm system going off. And so they're not able to differentiate between what's danger and what's fearful because alarm systems are bad, they don't work, they're faulty, they go off when they're not supposed to. Okay. It also helps promote guilt and shame and fear, right? Why do I feel like this? I shouldn't be feeling this way. Why do I get so anxious when it comes to these things if I'm not supposed to be anxious about these things? Imagine if you had a really awful, stressful day. You try to go to work in the morning, you leave your keys inside, you have to go back in, all the kids are screaming, trying to get them ready to go. And then you get into your car, your car's not starting, you have to call someone to fix it. And then you get to work, and your boss is yelling at you, and you're behind on all the paperwork that you have to do. And then you get home, and you realize that you didn't defrost chicken, and you have to go to Kroger to buy something quickly. You have to get all five kids in the car, go to Kroger, get food, come back, try and get everything up on time. And then your husband walks in, and you say, oh my gosh, you would not believe the day I had. It was so stressful, and all these things happen, and you kind of go through your day. And he looks at you and goes, normally it's not much of a big deal. what are you getting so stressed about? Like, calm down. Like, really not a big deal. Like, all you had to do was just, like, get the kids in the car and get them out of the car and go to work and come home and make food. So, really not such a huge deal, right? What would that feel like for you?
Like, what?
Yeah, it's almost as ridiculous as someone telling you that you're not cold when you're feeling cold.
Right.
Like, but I am, right? And so when a kid says, I'm worried about this, I'm anxious about this, my fire alarm is going off, it's not helpful to tell them no, it's not, right? It's frustrating and it's invalidating. The second thing that we do is we try to be very helpful by helping the child avoid their fears. So this is something that you're scared of, let's not do that at all. Right? You don't like to speak in front of the class, I'm going to call your teacher and let them know never to call on you so that you don't ever have to be in front of the class and never experience that anxiety, right? Will that work? Yes. They won't ever have to face a situation that's anxiety-provoking, right? So no anxiety, right? But what you're doing is you're reinforcing that standing in front of the classroom is something that my alarm should go off for. So we're almost creating hyper-anxiety about something that shouldn't be as anxious as worrying, right? What happens with anxiety response is that when we're faced with an anxiety-provoking situation, our anxiety goes up really high. The quicker that we take that down, the more our brain learns that path of this is what reduces anxiety. So anxiety goes up, I avoid it, my anxiety shoots back down. And then my brain learns, oh, okay, the way that we stop being anxious is we just don't do all the things, okay? Which, in long term, is not very helpful because you have to do things as we get older. And kids have to do things, right? And what's very important to remember is that bravery and courage cannot exist without fear, right? If you do something that's not necessarily so difficult for you to do, it's not bravery, it's not courage, it might be responsibility, it might be work ethic, it might be integrity, but it's not bravery and fear, and bravery and courage. And bravery and courage are something that we want is to have. It's a skill that we want to foster in kids because when it comes to social pressure, when it comes to confidence of doing something that other people are not, when it comes to listening to my inner voice, when it comes to going outside my comfort zone, I want them to be able to do that. I want them to foster that skill of bravery and courage, right? And if I don't give them opportunities to do that, then all I learn is when something comes up that makes me scared, I leave. So let's talk about the two ways that we can be helpful in long term. So the first is noticing out loud. Noticing out loud kind of has these two portions. There's accepting the concerns and then separating the self from the self. So accepting concerns is a little bit more, is easier to understand, right? So don't tell them they're not cold when they're feeling cold. They're feeling worried about something. They're feeling worried about something. It's not, you can't, transplant your emotions onto somebody else. They're feeling anxious about something, they're feeling anxious, right? So say, I see you're worried about that. I can see you're anxious about that. I see it makes you nervous. Okay? What you're feeling is valid and okay. The second part is a little bit harder to understand, I think. Teaching your child to separate their self from their thoughts. So I'll give you an example of this. Has anybody ever gone to work when they were tired? Right. Except that your brain is sending you a message that says, you are tired. You need to sleep now. Fall asleep. Right? Get into bed and go to sleep. You're exhausted. Your eyes are closing and your body's heavy and you can't do this. Right? But what do you treat tiredness as? You treat tiredness as a message from your brain that's telling you you're tired. You have the physical effects of it. You have thoughts that you're tired. It's a message from your brain. You look at that message and you say, well, yes, I am tired, but I also have to go to work, right? And the work part is more important right now because I need to make money, because people are counting on me, because that's my responsibility, And so this is a message, and I'm still going to do what I'm going to do. If we can teach kids to create, to use anxiety as a message and say, okay, I'm feeling anxious. My body's telling me I'm anxious. My brain is telling me I'm anxious. Let me look at this message. Is this something I need to listen to? Is this something I need to do to get out of this situation? Or is this just a message that I can put on the side and say, yes, you are feeling worried about this, but you still got to stand up and speak in front of the class, or you still have to go to the doctor, you still have to go to the dentist, right?
Get a job.
Yeah, right? So what we're trying to do is almost speak in a way, use language that separates the worry from the self. When the amygdala gets triggered, when that fight or flight system gets triggered, it's trained to assess danger and then help you plan to escape it. And the way that it does that is it makes it very real. When your alarm system goes off and starts going through all those what-ifs and all that anxiety, it's almost like it's happening right now, right? It's your reality right now. It's so close you can feel it happening, right? And what we want kids to be able to do is to separate from that and say, it's not happening right now. It's my brain telling me that these are potential dangers, but it's not happening right now. It's just a message that my brain is giving me. Right. So accepting those worries, I see that you're worried. I see that you're anxious. You sound really scared about that. What's your worry brain telling you? What are those messages? And when we're talking to kids, we'll actually say it like that. We'll call it your worry brain. We'll call it those worry messages. We'll talk about the worried part of your brain. Some kids like to, I had a couple of kids that like to name it Amy, which is short for amygdala. What's Amy telling you today? And then an important part of this is also assessing for any misunderstandings or misinterpretations. So, for example, the way that we kind of assess danger is we use little bits and pieces of previous knowledge that we have from other people, from things that we've heard, from things that we see, and we put it together into this potential danger disaster movie. Okay? Kids are really good at doing this, and they're also really good at doing this in completely wrong ways, right? They take little bits of information, they make this story that is not necessarily close to reality. And so just checking to make sure, you know, what's the scariest part about this for you? How much do you know about this? And just checking to make sure that they actually know what's going on. So for example, if you have a kid that's going to the dentist, just, you know, checking to see what's the serious part about that, because you might have a little kid that says, well, when I get to the doctor, they're going to pull out all my teeth because I went to the doctor and they got their wisdom teeth taken out, and so when I go to the doctor, they're going to take my teeth out, right? And then we can kind of deal with that, right? So you have worry messages in your brain that are telling you that the dentist is going to take all your teeth out. This actually happened yesterday when we went to, we had to get life checks. I'm going to use the tower as an example of this. I told the kids that they have to go for life checks at the winery, and Tara started screaming. And I said, Tara, do you know what a life check is?
No.
I was like, okay, do you want me to tell you what a life check is? She said, yeah. I said, okay, Mrs. Weiner is going to look through your hair like this, and I showed her. She's going to check to make sure there are no buggies in your hair. Like, oh, okay. Did we get the light check? Did we get ISIS after? And then, you know, she was able to pay attention to her worry brain, pay attention to the message that I was giving her, and then realize that the message that my worry brain is giving me is not important, not necessary, not true, not helpful, and I can still do what I need to do. And then the second piece after that is the problem-solving piece. So sometimes just doing the first piece is really all within you. Very often, we have to jump to that second piece, which is teaching kids problem-solving skills. So we want to, the main focus is helping a kid access their internal and external resources. How can you calm yourself down? What can you tell yourself? And who can you ask for help when it comes to a scary situation where your alarm system is running off? Right. So asking them questions, how do you think this will work? What will you do first? Who can you ask for help? Where am I on time? And so here are some kind of helpful phrases that we use to kind of go through those different components. So can you tell me about it? What's your worry brain telling you? How big is your worry? Where do you feel it on your body? Those kinds of things help them, again, separate the reality and their self from this message that they're getting. When you say how big is the worry, it's almost like this thing that's separate from you. It's a message that your brain is telling you. It's not my reality. It's not myself. It's not everything. Because when you become anxious, when your fight or flight system goes off, it becomes everything. So can you draw it? Can you give your brain some different ending options? What else do you know about it? Which coping strategy do you want to use? Who can you ask for help if you need it? It's scary and you're safe and you've done this before and you've been okay. Notice how we use the word and, right? It's scary and you're safe, right? It's not scary, but you're safe, right? Which kind of negates the scary part, right? You're safe, so you don't have to be scared. You can be scared and also do something, because that's really what we're trying to train to do. You can be scared and go to the doctor. You can be scared and give a speech. You can be scared and go to the dentist, and you can be scared and deal with it. So a lot of parents also like to use pre-teaching, and I didn't put this into the things not to do because there is a way to use it in an effective way. Very often, parents do use pre-teaching in a way that provides reassurance and certainty. So if I kind of map out every single thing that's going to happen, I walk through the entire situation, then they won't be anxious, which makes a lot of sense because if they know exactly what to expect, there's no need for the danger alarm to go off. Ever. I don't know about you guys, but my life is not always very certain, right? There's a lot of things that happen that are unexpected. And so the more that we train kids that your anxiety can only be okay when I walk you through the exact situation and say, first we're going to do this, and then 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 we're going to go home, right? What happens if something changes along the way? And then your kid can't handle it, right? What happens if you walk them exactly through the school day? This is what you do first, this is what you do second, this is what you do third, and what if there's a fire alarm in the middle of the day? What if a teacher gets sick and a substitute has to come in, right? So you're not training kids to manage anxiety, you're training kids to manage this exact situation in this exact way. So when we're using pre-teaching, what we're doing is we're talking about the situation to desensitize the brain. We want the brain to say, oh, this is a situation that I've done before. I've seen this before. It's okay. Alarm system doesn't have to go off. Did anybody talk to their kids about cicadas or classes, like in school, about cicadas? What did you do?
We had a very, very, very successful cicada experience. I talked to them about what I knew and before, and I showed up. I just, whatever, me, I showed excitement about, I use a lot of I wonder what it will be like, mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, are they going to even be on our playground, I wonder, is there even going to be around, maybe they're only going to be in that neighborhood, I wonder, so many that will be crunching all over them, like, I just described it in a lot of ways, and then once we started seeing one or two, I taught them how to hold them, I taught them how to be with them, they would be, I just modeled a lot of, like, real mm-hmm. comfortable, like, experience around it, because I knew they were harmless and it was like the perfect form of experience. And I also tied it into Barishas. It was like the perfect school time or whatever. So it just worked really well for my class. And I had a whole bunch of boys and they were just like coming into it. And then eventually they turned into like, you know, we were harvesting.
Did you tell them that the cicadas are not going to fly around the living place or that it might not land on them?
No. I just told them as much as I could about it.
Right. So notice how you gave them the might happen, the will happen, right? Those cicadas are going to come up, and all these things that might happen. They might be on a playground, they might be crunching, they might fly around, right? I didn't say, there's going to be cicadas, don't worry, because they're only going to stay in the trees, and they don't make a lot of noise, and they will not land on you. Right? I have a cicada that went up my dress. Okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what we want is to desensitize the brain, to say, this is something that I've dealt with before, I've seen this before, the alarm system doesn't have to go off. And that's kind of what we do in therapy sometimes. People kind of associate this with if you have a fear of snakes and the therapist like shoves you in a room with snakes and closes the door and like lets you sit there and scream until you're fine.
Yeah.
So it's not really how it works.
Yeah.
But yeah, we kind of really very opposed to that. Yeah. So we do slow desensitization. So we'll look at pictures of cicadas and we'll talk about cicadas. We'll get a video. Until our brain recognizes this thing and says, oh, this is something I've seen before. My body was safe when I looked at that thing. And so this is not a situation where my alarm system has to go off. And the most important thing with pre-teaching is do not lie. Don't tell your kid something that's not going to happen. It might, again, short-term parenting, it might get you to the doctor if you tell them that you're not going to get any shots. But you completely lose credibility. You lose all trust in your kids. They don't trust you. They don't trust their own instincts. It increases anxiety because what else is are people not telling me about? And anytime you give reassurance, you're going to say, why?
Well, many of the things we've brought up so far, which I don't think we'll stress enough to say, oh, get away. So many things we've brought up are things that are like in actuality, like they're not particularly harmful. Like that is not so harmful, it's helpful, but like it really doesn't hurt that much. Potatoes, while unpleasant, which they definitely are, they don't hurt. But like I'm thinking back to like an hour or two ago with the thunderstorm, which also like it's not usually harmful, but like as we've seen here, not so long ago, like it could cause real harm. You know, thing at this time, like my kids, I have one kid in particular who was nervous and pretty thunderstorm like a week and a half ago, and like in his basement. But this time, like chose to close the shades. So like that's fine, but for me to say, you survived this before, like that's great. But like thunderstorms can be dangerous, and they do cause trees to fall down and cause tremendous damage. Mm-hmm. So that I wonder if you are going to address like what things actually are dangerous and how to handle that.
Yeah, well, I think the same thing applies. When you're teaching them to look at their worry in an objective way and to say it's okay to worry, we want them to worry in situations that are potentially unsafe, we want them to listen to that voice and say, okay, what's my worry voice telling me? It's telling me that my house is going to collapse when the thunderstorm comes in, right? That's something that might not be an alarm that has to go off, but it's telling me that I shouldn't be outside during a thunderstorm. That's something we want them to listen to. And then that's where that problem-solving step comes in. So what is a safe choice right now?
Are you, in other words, just saying that when you're feeling worried, you're trying to get yourself away from the emotional reaction to becoming logical?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Keeping the emotion out of it so that you can be logical and then calm yourself down and de-escalate because you're being so logical about what's happening.
So you kind of want both. You don't want to get out of the emotion. The anxiety and worry is the emotion, right? And you're allowing it to be there. You're allowing it to be there without being uncomfortable with it, without being scared of it, without trying to get it away. Usually the problem comes when we try to push out the anxiety itself, right? So it's not the anxiety that's the problem. It's how much it's interfering with your daily functioning. The anxiety is the voice that we want to listen to. But when does it get in the way?
So if the child is saying, mommy, I'm really scared, then you're basically just trying to hold their hand through being scared, like going through labor
and
kind of thing.
And
it's going to be over at some point, but right now we're going through it and you're scared and you're scared and
you're
scared.
You're scared and you're still
supporting.
Yeah, you're scared and you can still do the things that you need to do. And so it feels scary, but you can still give the speech. And you feel scared, but you can still go to the dentist. And accessing those resources. So how do you calm yourself down? Who do you ask for help? What do you need at this moment? So that when they're an adult, they can do that for themselves, right? I know that when I go to the dentist, I need to have headphones on very loud so I don't hear any drills. Right? And so those are my resources, right? But if I don't listen to that voice and I say, this is ridiculous, you're just going to the dentist, right? I can't access those resources. I know it's not a run out of the house fire alarm, but it's smoke fire alarm that I need to manage.
So are you just teaching the kids coping mechanisms?
Yeah, but
so each anxiety they have ways to push through and deal with it.
Yeah, but again, push through doesn't mean getting rid of the anxiety.
No. Just what I mean is like
getting through it.
Yeah, getting through it, finding tools that they could use that help them get through it, whether it's on their own or without.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, so we'll take the thunderstorm example. You have different ranges of ages of children who are scared of thunderstorms. Let's just say your 10-year-old is not showing signs of scared, maybe he's still unpleasant, right? Let's say. So, would you then, like, okay, you're acknowledging the fear, saying, yeah, it's pretty scary. Wow, that was a really loud boom. Yeah. Oh, my God, you know, right? And then you start to use those coping questions like, you know, what's so scary about this particular storm? And if they say, well, the sound is really loud, or maybe the tree's gonna fall on our house and break through our window, and then would you just continue like working through what would happen? What would we do if that were to happen? You know, how would we stay safe? Would you start problem solving that whole scenario out with like, so that they feel like they have some level of control if that were to happen?
So it depends. It depends on the kid. It depends on the worry.
Like if the worry is, you know, the house is going to come tumbling down, then do they need a map? Do they need a verbal, like, go-through of, like, how would we save ourselves if this house was going to actually fall down?
So not necessarily. Sometimes they just need to know that it's unlikely that that happens, right? So I can't promise it won't happen, but I can say that it's unlikely, and right now you're safe, right? Right now our house is safe. Right now you're safe. Very unlikely that house is
going to fall down. So tell me, why doesn't it increase anxiety when you're not certain? Like, when you start to say, this might happen, why does that increase anxiety?
Because when you get stuck in the anxiety loop, your anxiety is really just looking for reassurance.
Right.
Right. And so you can't ever provide complete reassurance.
Because you can't put in on another. Ultimately, that's what you're saying. Like, because nobody can predict the future.
Right.
But if a child is looking to a pillar of a parent who, in their eyes, have the answers, mm-hmm. and they really want that security, and you're telling them, I don't know if our house is going to fall down, but if it does, I was like, why does that increase anxiety?
Right, so not like, if it does, this is then we'll call 911, right? Saying this is an unlikely event, now we're safe. What do we want to do next is more helpful. Yeah.
So I think, like, one way to provide, it's like the first thing is not just, like, jumping to the coping, but providing that framework that anxiety has its place.
Mm-hmm.
And anxiety can be like, it's like overestimating the likelihood of a negative outcome and underestimating our ability to cope with what's going to happen. So, you know, when we say might, that's kind of where that, it's like a child or a person is probably anticipating there's 90% likelihood that it might happen, you know, that it's likely to happen. And so we're kind of like trying to maybe even just bring it down a notch and say, it feels like, and it might happen, but the likelihood of it happening is really small. Versus like inevitability, or versus them thinking it's 99% likely versus 5% possibility.
So it's more realistic, like it's a realistic event for them, so they can like, because right, you think a lot of it is like also understand like what, like misinterpretations or whatever. So like really understand the realistic part of it, that kind of like lessen. Anxiety. But the minute you said that, like, it's not really so much of what it is. It's, right? It's not what it is, but it's...
When it's a problem, it's how much it's interfering with functioning. We'll talk a little bit about how to recognize what interference looks like.
So how would if you're scared of something that happened to them before happening again? Like, one of my kids was terrified of the cicadas because when she went outside for a walk, it landed in her dress, and she couldn't find it, and when she heard it, it was terrifying to have this thing in her. She was like, terrified. She was so traumatized from it. But so do you want to go outside again? So how do you help them work through going outside again, you know, if she already was traumatized from that thing that happened to them?
Yeah. And a very scary experience. Yeah, like, yeah. So what you're talking about is your brain recognizing a dangerous situation and then being pre-programmed to prevent any future situations like that from happening. And the way that we do that is really like kind of process the situation, let our brain kind of run through that that scenario, talk about it, talk about what was so scary about it, and talk about how you managed it, how okay you were after, so we can kind of shut off that alarm that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like waving the towel in front of the fire alarm with the sniffles.
Right, make it not as loud as an alarm.
Mm-hmm.
It will be there if something happens.
Yeah. And then we'll talk about recognizing that it's interfering, that the kid is so scared that they're not leaving their house at all and start screaming, crying, and refusing to go to school and play with friends, then it's a problem and then we might need some extra support.
Where does humor come in? Like using humor, for example, is that...
Yeah.
Like if you're saying you had that experience of it and you were scared or something, but like looking back, maybe as parents we can be kind of laugh about it or something with...
So is it that situation or in general? Because in general, when we're talking about the worried brain, we're talking
mm-hmm.
about the anxiety. So when we take the anxiety seriously and we say,
mm-hmm.
you know, it sounds very scary for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to make jokes about that part.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about the worried brain, I kind of want to make fun of the worried brain because the worried brain is like that unhelpful friend sitting next to you, tapping your shoulder all the time, going, scary, it's going to be scary, you're not going to be okay, right? And so we kind of humorize that piece of that worried brain. You know, it's this an annoying radio station that's playing in the background that's giving you unhelpful messages.
That's a good point. I had a situation, and like the day before, like one of my kids were like screaming bloody murder, and I thought when she fell down, and I came out of the bathroom like literally half like whatever. It's like, this kid was having. I was like, oh my god, that was stuck in like glass and like I don't know, blood everywhere, you know. I was like, okay. I'll go back to the bathroom. And then like the next day, I was like in my car, and I heard this like crazy croaking sound. I'm like, no. I was like, I was like, oh my gosh, okay, so I was upsetting, like a crazy funny story, but it was so scary, and I was so upset, but yeah, I definitely used that, and I kept saying that story over and over, and it felt like it did kind of humor, it does make it a little bit more, right?
And then your brain associates that situation, and the amygdala says, danger situation. Your brain says, oh, that's a situation that I felt okay with, because I've seen that, I've recognized it, and it was like a funny situation. So your brain starts associating that with something that's fun and funny and humorous.
Right.
Right.
But so, the more you actually like bring that attention to that, and kind of on a lesson and bring more attention.
So we'll talk a little bit about modeling, and we use a lot of humor with modeling.
Right. So you said that talking through it and processing the experience is helpful.
Yeah.
So if you notice that it kind of keeps recurring, like there's, like the processing or the talking about it might be helpful, but like is there a worry that the more you talk about it, the more you're obsessed about it, and then it becomes worse?
So,
or is processing and going through always helpful?
So if the processing and the rumination becomes what if, what if, then it's not helpful. The processing is more, what was that experience like for you? Tell me about what you felt, and how did you manage it, and where did you feel safe? And the processing is kind of that piece, because the worry brain kind of gets stuck on these anxiety loops, and it replays it over and over and over again so that I can make sure that it doesn't happen again. So if I keep it very forefront of my mind, I can speak and detect any potential danger and get rid of it.
Right.
So processing it lets the worry brain kind of let go of it. Like I'm kind of, I go through the situation and I talk about the experience, and then it allows the worry brain to let kind of let go for now. If it's coming up very frequently, what you're talking about is intrusive thoughts or flashbacks or you know, more kind of like post-traumatic.
Because like thunderstorms come all the time. So if it's a thunderstorm, right, then well I can turn off because it's feeling weird. But like if you have to process every thunderstorm and then you know what I mean, like that can be impressive.
And so then saying, you know, thunderstorms are an issue for this kid, isn't it? A lot of thunderstorms comes up. They freak out.
Yeah, I guess my question is, is it creating more of a fear because you're now drawing so much attention to it and you're processing it with them? Well, you know, I heard already what you said about you don't want to diminish or negate the feelings, it's acknowledging, but sometimes it's there's some things that can be acknowledged and then you move on, and then there's some things that, like, should have been moved on with that you decide to process, and that shouldn't be done. And then it becomes like the processing, something that really could have been moved on with, and now you're obsessing about it.
Right.
So, is there a way to tell without like walking into situations where now you're creating a lot of other anxieties and fears in children because you decided to process it to be a good parent and or to be a good teacher, and now you created a bigger problem for yourself?
Right. I think that if the kid is showing those symptoms and you process it, that's healthy. If they're not showing any symptoms and you're like, well, let's process this because it was a scary situation. Let's kind of go through all of it. What are you feeling and thinking and doing, right? Then you can create anxiety that wasn't necessarily there before. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're kind of, the kid has, seems like, has created some closure or has resolved and keep on checking in. Remember that scary situation that you're in?
Also, that can happen in classroom settings because you have so many different children and, you know, some things can be very scary for our kids, and you can start to process it, and it's like, I don't know, there's a lot of different, people are in different spots,
right.
So that can kind of inevitably happen accidentally.
More individual.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
of that desensitizing in a way that we're doing a little bit of social learning. So I'm desensitizing to you to the situation because I'm introducing it to you in small quantities in a way that's safe. But I'm also talking about somebody else that's going through the situation so that the kid can learn, yeah, it's normal to worry and it's normal to have coping skills and other people can get through it too. So with social story, you make up a story with a real life scenario depicting the anticipated event, right? So like Yoli's mommy's going to London, mommy's getting an x-ray. It doesn't have to end and then she wasn't scared anymore. It can end and then she was okay. Spirit did the thing and this is how she dealt with it and then she was okay. But it doesn't have to end and then she wasn't scared of the afternoon. Right? Because again, fear is a normal part of life. It's going to come up. And come in different situations. We want kids to be comfortably uncomfortable. When those uncomfortable situations come up, I'm comfortable with being uncomfortable and I can manage it. The kind of key elements of the social story are what's happening, the emotions associated with it, what some of those coping skills are, and then kind of, again, being okay with not being okay. So, for example, Maki doesn't really like thunderstorms. They're very loud, noisy. She's scared sometimes. So when thunderstorms come up, she likes to have a room in color, and she likes to listen to music, and sometimes she drinks tea with her mommy. Does not like thunderstorms at all. But she knows that thunderstorms pass, and soon they end, and then tomorrow will be sunny. Okay. So situation, the emotions that she was processing, the things that she did to cope, and it was okay even though it wasn't really okay. Sometimes, again, like we said, the fight or flight system goes off, the worry thoughts come in, and then our body has a physiological response. Sometimes that physiological response takes over. It's all we can pay attention to. Shallow breathing, increased heart rate, our muscles start getting like jelly feeling. Our stomach stops working, so you can get a lot of stomach pain, nausea. And sometimes that's all that we can pay attention to. We can't start like thinking about this is my worry brain or how can I problem solve. And so sometimes we need to first calm that physiological response, and then we can start talking about that. See that it really made you scared, and then talking through that. So some of the things that we use to calm the physiological response are diaphragmatic breathing. When your fight or flight system goes off, you do shallow chest breathing. Diaphragmatic breathing is kind of like a signal to your brain to say, shut off the sympathetic nervous system, activate the opposite, the relaxation response, or the parasympathetic nervous system. And you can activate that because now you're safe and okay. And so the way that we train kids to do that is by taking deep breaths through their nose and out through their mouth, so smelling a flower, blowing a candle, and using that physical movement also helps kind of help them focus on what they're doing. Or we use belly breathing. We'll have them put one hand on their stomach, one hand on their chest, and almost fill up their stomach like a balloon as they inhale. Making sure that the bottom hand moves when you breathe and not the top, because that's how we know that you're doing diaphragmatic breathing, not shallow chest breathing.
But another thing to add is just when you smell flower and it then the little trails, you're blowing the petals away. So like it makes it like a little bit more
And then keeping your child grounded in the moment. So remember that worry brain, that what if, is making it as if it's actually happening right now. You get stuck in the fear, the potential, is your brain is playing it out as if it's happening right now. So moving them from what if to what is. What do you see right now? What colors can you identify? Can you pick three things that are green, four things that are red? How many birds do you see in the tree? And let them know that right now you're okay, right now you're safe. Even though your brain is telling you these messages, this is what's happening for your body right now. Engaging in a task that requires concentration, again, it draws attention from the worry brain and the cycle that's going on, that fight or flight system, to concentrating on something. So asking them to count how many people are wearing hats, playing an X-Y game. I wouldn't do, like, complicated mental math with a kid in that moment. If you think about a situation where you're in fight or flight, like, let's say you were driving and a car cuts you off really suddenly. If I asked you what 1 + 1 is in that moment, you probably wouldn't be able to answer me because you're in the middle of fight or flight. If you had someone kind of coaching you, take a deep breath, what can you find that's red, and then you can kind of bring that physiological response down. And then calming activities also activate the relaxation response, because right now I'm safe, right now I'm okay, right now I'm doing something that I enjoy, coloring, playing with a favorite toy, reading a book, blowing bubbles, and that reminds your brain that right now you're not in any danger, the reality here. And that will shut down the physiological response.
So if you have a child who already does these responses when they're going through something that gives them anxiety, mm-hmm. do you still need to talk about it afterwards, or you could just let it go?
It depends on the kid. I mean, you might want to just say, you know, I saw that you were using that belly breathing. That was great work.
But you don't have to talk about the experience anymore. You could just give them, like, kudos for what you did.
Yeah, as long as they're kind of accepting that worry and recognizing that worry, that means that they're doing a really good job at listening to that worry brain, knowing when that message is going off, calming themselves down, and slowly what they have to do. So they're doing exactly what you want them to do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What do you do when a child is, they'll do something to distract themselves, like a moment, and they'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when they do that, they feel horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my gosh, that thing is that. Mm-hmm. Now they have, like, maybe they were okay at the time, but mm-hmm. now they have this new, like, association.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's when you're using a behavior almost as an avoidance activity more than a relaxing activity.
Okay.
So this helps me avoid the anxiety as opposed to experience the anxiety in a safe way. Right. So that's why the anxiety might still be present. It's not really relaxing, it's avoidance.
Right, it's distracted.
Distracted.
So they couldn't even focus what they were going through.
Yeah.
So they never left. Now they just joined the new.
Right, so now that's part of the anxiety also. we're kind of
no, we're doing like a 10-hour thing.
Like cramming it. Like, the most important part of this is assisting yourself before you help others. That kind of classic, putting the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on somebody else. Because if you're not getting any oxygen, you're going to be too busy, too overwhelmed, and too anxious to help anybody else that's going through that. And so making sure you take care of your own physical and emotional well-being, making sure you put
and that is any anxiety that you have.
Knowing yourself, learning to identify your own emotions and your internal and external resources. Now I know I'm overwhelmed. This is what I need to do when I'm overwhelmed. And modeling, talking about those experiences out loud, talking about the emotions out loud, problem solving, reflecting on those uncertain moments, right? So this is where I use humor a lot. Because I can tell the kids, I'm going to get caught tonight because I'm nervous. I'm not grand. I'm worried what is going on. You're going to say something. Right? And then you're really like, stop. I'm going to get caught. Stop, right? That's your worry brain. We know your worry brain. Right? What are you going to do? You're going to take deep breaths? Right? Do you want to go for a walk? And so showing her that it's okay to feel not okay and still do what I want to do, even in that not okayness, using my external resources, using my internal resources, asking for help, but being okay with the uncertainty, right, is kind of the best model of telling her that you can be anxious, you can get through this.
Well, I think it's really important. I feel like sometimes we feel like we have to model with always like super heroes
okay.
And like we're okay and like really like no, mommy's right. Having a hard time right now, or like it is very stressful, and like I think kids have exposure on
top of
that level.
Yeah. The kind of differentiation that I make is when you make your anxiety the kid's anxiety. Mm-hmm. So you're not
really worried about like how we're gonna pay the bills today, right?
we're not like transferring that anxiety over to kids so it's something that they can worry about. We're talking about successful experiences that we've had, being worried, being uncertain, and getting through. Because what you're teaching kids is that it's okay. We want to listen to our alarm system. We want to evaluate, is this a danger situation or is this just a fear situation? And then what do I do in those situations? Do I run out of the house or do I need to leave a towel in front of the fire alarm?
I did that with the kids a lot, and I was like, don't come here.
And then the kind of last part is when to seek professional help. And like I said, it's not about the worry, it's about when the worry is interfering. So when the child's worry is interfering with family functioning or the child's own functioning, that's when it's a problem. When the anxiety becomes a thing that the whole family has to work around, we all kind of cater to this anxiety, we do things around this anxiety, that's when it's a problem. When there's disagreements about how we manage this anxiety between parents, if we're not on the same page about how we deal with this, that's when it's a problem. Or when you just feel out of your element, you're not sure what to do, there's a kid obviously experiencing anxiety and you just don't know how to help them. And then we'll finish with just some signs that worries are interfering with daily functioning. These are the kids that have frequent physical distress, lots of headaches, stomach nausea, trouble breathing, vomiting, trouble sleeping. Those are some signs that your child's worry is interfering with their daily functioning. Poor concentration and decision making, they just are like kind of foggy and not present all the time. That kid that has the running stream of catastrophic and pessimistic thoughts, everything's going to go bad, it's going to go wrong, this is awful, we're going to, like, this is not going to be okay, nothing's ever going to be okay. The kids that have high irritability, snap very quickly, poor frustration tolerance, can't deal with those transitions very well or anything that's outside of their comfort zone very well. Kids that have a lot of perfectionism, very self-critical. So when the worries start interfering with their sense of self, their self-esteem, that's when it's a problem, right? Nothing that I do is ever good enough. The overly responsible people-pleasing kids, right? Always worrying, are you upset with me or upset with me? Do you think it's okay? Are they okay with me? Did I do something wrong? Those are the kids that they're worrying is interfering with their ability to have normal social engagement, have a sitting class and listen to the teacher, because I'm constantly worrying about what people are thinking of me. And then the last one is for kids that need to have unusual things done or done in a certain way in order to engage or disengage from an activity. So if they organize things, have to organize things a certain way, if they have to wash a certain way or wash things, touching, counting, spending a lot of time at a task or doing and redoing tasks in order for it to be just right before I can kind of disengage and let it go, those are kids also that the worry is interfering with daily functioning. And then what I would say, there's this clear understanding that our medical, physical health and our mental health are not as separate as we think, that ongoing stress, anxiety that's not managed has a significant effect on physical health. And the kind of key places to make sure that you are seeing, first of all, if in any brain anxiety, just make sure you're touching base with the kid's doctor. The pediatrician should know that the kid is more anxious and having some difficulty. But if there's sudden onset anxiety in a kid that doesn't usually have anxiety, there's not really an identifiable trigger, those are times that you're not going to just want to use coping resources and see how this plays out. This is a kid that needs some sort of evaluation to see where this can be from, if it's a medical issue, if it's a mental health issue. If there's some trigger that you don't necessarily know about, this is a kid who was never anxious before and all of a sudden has jumped signs of anxiety. Anxiety that's uncharacteristic happens quickly, or they start socially withdrawing more than usual, their grades start slipping, they're not sleeping as well. Also, kind of that sudden onset where they're doing things that are not like them. So that's why maybe you want to let a pediatrician know or get an evaluation. And then the last and most important thing to know is that none of us have this parenting thing figured out perfectly. We kind of learn as we go along. And just the fact that you're here wanting to learn some of these strategies just shows that you're doing a good job just by wanting to get better. So I want to vote that.
Thank you. I was actually going to like write everything down, and I was going to, if it was okay with you, I was going to share. I'm like, oh my God, I need these like papers with me all the time. So I was going to share, maybe if you're okay with it, the slideshow with you guys so that you can always just take it. It's almost to digest. I feel like it was really clear and so organized, and like, I feel like I should still ask you. Anyone has any questions or whatever, I don't know if it's like, if you have any, feel free, still feel free, you have to stay. But yeah, if you have any questions or whatever,
When you're working with pages or like children, and you're helping them, and you're coaching maybe the parents too on how to help the kids. Do you have recommendations that you share with parents about how to like most effectively interface with the school and like advocate for the child, communicate with the school about what the child is going through, and also something to steer away from?
So, I mean, generally recommend that everybody go on the same page. That's it.